welcome to Claudio's Speakeasy and Radio Theater. Your host, bard and renaissance man of WCOM, has opened the doors to invite you in to take a break from the workaday world. And he's coming over now. Hello and good morning, Claudio.
Gotta put the broom down. Good morning, yes. Cabro. Big chill and everyone tuning us in. We're happy to have you on board. We're going to try something new on the Speakeasy today, but we'll surprise you with that in a few minutes. First, I'd like to acknowledge the historical Carolina Theater of Durham, who has, on the 22nd, which is this Friday coming up, I'll be stage managing Stephen Wright, the comedian, actually one of my absolute favorite comedians. He's off the wall, great. He's refreshing.
I've got CDs of him at home.
Yeah, he's still that good. He's got DVDs out now.
Well, my whole family knows lines.
Oh, yeah?
Calling up to find the telephone operator to find out where your socks are.
Totally off the wall. Yes, exactly. Will you stop playing with that switch, please? Yes. I remember he said he had the switch behind his fridge. He just bought this house, and he just couldn't figure out what it was there for. And so every once in a while he'd flip it, but nothing would happen. So one day he spent 15 minutes just, and he got this call from Switzerland saying, "Would you please stop messing with that switch?" So whatever that tells you. But he's so off the wall, he's refreshing.
Yes, he's good. Straight-faced.
Yes, so the Historic Carolina Theater, see what's happening there. That is definitely happening this Friday, and then there's a lot more stuff coming up. I'm really impressed to hear that they've got Al Jarreau coming.
Wow.
And that'll be in June, yeah.
So, very nice.
Some good things. There's always something unexpected happening at the Carolina.
They've got good stuff going on all
absolutely.
The time.
So drop by and say hello. And on that note, I guess what I'd like to sort of point out before we go anywhere this morning, politics out there is getting so stupid, not that it could have gotten any more foolish, but I came across this by way of a friend, and I think I should read it this morning. It's called 545 People by Charlie Rees. Here we go. Politicians are the only people in the world who create problems and then campaign against them. Have you ever wondered why, if both the Democrats and the Republicans are against deficits, we have deficits? Have you ever wondered why, if all the politicians are against inflation and high taxes, we have inflation and high taxes? You and I don't propose a federal budget. The president does. You and I don't have the constitutional authority to vote on appropriations. The House of Representatives does. You and I don't write the tax code. Congress does. You and I don't set fiscal policy. Congress does. You and I don't control monetary policy. The Federal Reserve Bank does, which, by the way, is not a federal institution at all. 100 senators, 435 congressmen, one president, and 9 Supreme Court justices, which equals 545 human beings, out of the 300 million, are directly, legally, morally, and individually responsible for the domestic problems that plague this country. I excluded members of the Federal Reserve Board because that problem was created by the Congress. In 1913, Congress delegated its constitutional duty to provide a sound currency to a federally chartered but private central bank. So this term, using the term Federal Reserve, is entirely inappropriate. I excluded all the special interests and lobbyists for a sound reason. They have no legal authority. They have no ability to coerce a senator, a congressman, or a president to do one cotton-picking thing. I don't care if they offer a politician $1 million in cash. They have no authority. The politician has the power to accept or reject it. No matter what the lobbyist promises, it is the legislator's responsibility to determine how he votes. Those 545 human beings spend much of their energy convincing you, and what they did is not their fault. Or convincing you that what they did is not their fault. Sorry, I'm stumbling here. They cooperate in this common con regardless of party. What separates a politician from a normal human being is an excessive amount of gall. No normal human being would have the gall of a speaker who stood up and criticized the president for creating deficits. The president can only propose a budget. He cannot force the Congress to accept it. The Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, gives sole responsibility to the House of Representatives for originating and approving appropriations and taxes. Who is the Speaker of the House? She is the leader of the majority party. She and fellow House members, not the president, can approve any budget they want. If the president vetoes it, they can pass it over his veto if they agree to. It seems inconceivable to me that a nation of 300 million cannot replace 545 people who stand convicted by present facts of incompetence and irresponsibility. I can't think of a single domestic problem that is not traceable directly to those 545 people. When you fully grasp the plain truth that 545 people exercise the power of the federal government, then it must follow that what exists is what they want to exist. If the tax code is unfair, it is because they want it unfair. If the budget is in the red, it is because they want it in the red. If the Marines are in Iraq, it is because they want them in Iraq. If they do not receive Social Security but are on elite retirement plan or retirement plans, which are not available to the people, it is because they want it that way. There are no insoluble government problems. Do not let these 545 people shift the blame to bureaucrats whom they hire and whose jobs they can abolish, to lobbyists whose gifts and advice they can reject, to regulators to whom they give the power to regulate and from whom they can take this power. Above all, do not let them con you into the belief that there exists disembodied mystical forces like the economy, inflation, or politics that prevent them from doing what they take an oath to do. Those 545 people, and they alone, are responsible. They and they alone have the power. They and they alone should be held accountable by the people who are their bosses, provided the voters have the gumption to manage their own employees. We should vote all of them out of office and clean up the mess.
And my regard or my response to that is they and they he's saying two things there. They and they alone are responsible.
Mm-hmm.
The people who put them in office are responsible.
Are responsible as well, absolutely. And we're the ones that are
exactly
maintaining too much time on that couch.
I think it's critical that everybody get up and start paying attention.
Absolutely.
More attention. And it starts at the local level. People don't automatically walk into the Senate out of nowhere or into the House of Congress. They start at lower levels. Get involved, everybody, in your local politics.
And so many average Joes.
That's where everything starts.
And so many average Joes and Josephines out there just shrug their shoulders and look at you and go, well, what can we do?
Exactly. It's the only thing that anybody can do is to get involved. Get involved locally. You know, think globally and act locally.
Absolutely. We can get together and fire them.
Yes.
That's what needs to be done.
He says there are employees.
Yes.
And it's the 545 people that this country has put in place.
Absolutely.
So the responsibility is in our laps.
They're breeding termites. Let's get rid of them.
Let's. Now anyway, we've got something else going on today, Claudio.
Actually, before we go there,
yes.
I'm going to impose on you for a moment. You told me something that was so bloody abstract this morning.
Yes.
I want you to repeat it.
Okay.
Something about gangs in L.A.
I was reading an article in yesterday's NNO, and it was one of these moments of lucidity that sort of strikes me as being, oh, yes, we are living in a lunatic world. They are now providing guided tours of L.A. gangland.
This is bus tours.
Bus tours. These tours are being led by ex-gang members. They have an unmarked bus for $65 and the signing of a waiver for lack of responsibility if you should be involved in a criminal act.
Just in case you get shot through the window.
Yes, a victim of crime. They will take you through the worst areas of gang activity in Los Angeles, which has its reputation as being one of the worst places in the country for gang activity. And in reading this, you don't know whether to laugh or cry or burn the paper.
It's nuts.
It's just, and the thing that came into my mind in reading this, I mean, I'm chuckling because it's just so crazy, is why don't we have tours and go to Haiti? you know, we can conduct tours of the devastation in on the island and the people's horrible suffering because they were living in a place that provided no security for them so far as structures or anything or livelihood or anything.
Well, we're not too far from doing that. Aren't they sending G.W. Bush over there to help rectify the problem? The same fellow who let New Orleans sink?
But there was something, and I would only hope that I really misread this, but did Pat Robertson really say that there was Haiti suffered this because of a pact with Satan?
That's what I was told, yes.
I mean...
Yeah, this holier-than-thou Pat Robertson.
I mean, anyway, this is just...
Why don't you give us...
It's a lunatic world, and...
Give us the footnote to the response that came
to
Pat Robertson. I like that one best.
Yes. Supposedly, Satan wrote a response saying,
Where was Satan
on.
From? California or somewhere? Midwest, I think.
At any rate, he said, come on, Pat, you know that anybody who's made a pact with me is living in the lap of luxury. They've got fame. They've got glory. They've
Remember
got
the bankers?
Giving me a bad rap. Go back to blaming it on God. I mean, and then the end of his response was... You know, Pat, if you keep this up, we're going to have to renegotiate your contract.
I love that.
So
there you go. That's the medicine for the day, and
yes.
I've decided I know what to do with the monitors they're going to have at the airport now, where they see you naked and some pervert in the closet is watching you. I've decided just get underwear that says "kiss my ass."
Oh dear!
And that way they'll get the message.
Well, I think your last one was everybody should strip as they walk in.
Yes, that's just to beat them to the punch. I'll probably do that next flight I take, but I don't know when that'll be.
They'll take you away. The little men in the white coats will take you away.
Well, if I'm part of a nudist colony, that's legit.
I don't think the airport is part of a nudist colony. Anyway... Yes, we have something going on today, and this is the grand opening here at the Speakeasy of the Speakeasy's Radio Theater.
Indeed, something that Audrey and I have been talking about since we first started sharing the airtime.
Right, and it's something that's been percolating in the station for a while, and many people would be interested in doing this.
I think so, yeah.
And we're just taking off here this morning, and everybody out there in our radio land is being part of this great new venture here.
So we're going to lull you into some poetry, some stories. We're going to be very short and to the point.
Uh-huh.
Nothing to lull you to sleep. Hopefully something to lull you into a greater consciousness.
Right. And Claudia, do you want to start off with something?
Ah, yes. Actually, I was telling you this story about a friend of mine who lived in, or actually he sold the house now, but he lived in Villanova, Pennsylvania. I was at Philadelphia. Pennsylvania.
Let's set the mood here going on. The house lights are dimming at Claudio Speakeasy, and we're settled back in our chairs, ready to be entertained. And the spotlight is on the bard coming to center stage of the Speakeasy Radio Theater. Listen up.
Oh, I'm just having me brandy. Is it my turn to go on?
Yes. Oh. I'm pushing him out on stage,
That's
folks.
That's it. Anyhow, I went to visit a very dear friend of mine by the name of Miles Martell, who was actually the communications counsel to Ronald Reagan, and I believe... in an advisory capacity to quite a few other presidents. When I went to visit him in his small mansion there in Pennsylvania, his study was dedicated strictly and exclusively for himself, red carpet, had a portrait of every president the United States has ever had signed on the walls and to a security device, and it was this beautiful bay window that was maintained without a curtain, so you could see the outside. It was about 15 degrees with a wind chill factor of 45 miles an hour, so it was... blooming cold out there. Mm-hmm. And we spend our entire evening communicating in that particular little nook. And at the end of the communication, I said, look, Miles, would you mind if I just sort of rolled up my sleeping bag and slept on the floor in here with this wonderful energy? I said, I don't know. I might want to write something overnight or when I wake up in the morning. I'm just very connected here. Can I sleep in this room? And he allowed me to. So I remember waking up early the next morning. Before my eyes were completely open, I just sort of sensed these shadows moving about the room. And it was the light of daybreak, bleak as it was, illumining the trees right outside the window, massive oaks, that were just swaying in the wind, and their branches were just throwing shadows all about the room, all about the president's faces and the famous authors that he had up there and so on. And I was so taken by that I this just poured out of me, and I wrote this piece called Skeletal repose. Now to see if I can remember it. The swaying, rhythmic, restless stride of winter branches thin and wide, so skeletal in their repose as windward motions they expose, like arms that reach beyond man's prayers, where distant realms greet distant stares. And yet, beyond allure defined, they reach within the soul, the mind, to all that speaks of God to me when I gaze long upon a tree.
Ah, I really respond to that.
I love trees for one thing, and that was yes. Jack Frost inspired. Jack Frost mm-hmm. was there, but actually Robert Frost inspired.
But you can picture it. You can see the trees. We can look out the window right now and see the winter trees.
And I was in the ambience of it when I wrote it, so uh-huh. I was completely trapped in that spirit
right.
and it just poured out.
And especially when you think of the way the light comes through, and you're talking about when you first started saying the flickering shadows, I was thinking, okay, they're the ghosts of the presence.
Yes, it was definitely a presence in the room.
Yes,
and I tend to like the metaphysical, so I'm not uh-huh. intimidated. But I definitely sensed there was an energy about me, and then I opened my eyes and just saw this constant
swirling
branches. Yeah,
right. So we can all kind of relate to that. And
then I stepped outside the door and went woof and ran back in.
I would think so, but that's a beautiful poem.
But thank you. That was and the interesting thing is I scripted it and designed it the way I do much of uh-huh. my poetry when people request it for framing, and I did it as a gift to my friend Miles Martel, uh-huh. and in return he showed me, he did not give me, I wish he had, a uh-huh. book that he actually had signed by Robert Frost.
Uh-huh.
So it was the inspiration
right.
continued for a while.
Yes, 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 yes. Well, that was great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's just something I thought we'd
bring
the mood in
start
with.
Start the theater in.
Create the ambient.
Okay.
Now, did you want to go into something that I had mentioned this to you before? I didn't know that this was one of the more unusual pieces I've written. And I've always thought it was written for a woman that had an appreciation for art for her voice to convey. And
well,
you just seem a natural.
Let's try this. The title is Into the Abstract and Out of the Blue by Claudio Oswald Niedrock. Neruda Picatice, artist and lover of both Impressionism, for its licentious lack of detail, and the abstract, for the uninhibited originality of design and detail it is possessed of, and to which it is evermore a canvas of opportunity, was as bohemian in his demeanor as he was obsessed with his art. The early, mildly temperate afternoon held an otherwise unusual and yet likely promise of sun outside his quaint Italian cottage. This particular midsummer had been to him a season of considerable discontent, as it had been an obstacle of rains and winds that were neither conducive to canvas nor paint. The tempest of restlessly moody days had left his soul somewhat less than illumined or inspired, but an innate commitment and discipline, along with a routine kettle of South African rooibos tea, drew him ever so habitually to his easel and palette. Both were already arranged in anticipation of a splendid harvest of meditative hours spent painting amid the shading, elongated cedars and pines of his annual refuge. An artistically picturesque, however exhausted, miscellany of partially used paint tubes and well-worn brushes also awaited him there. Exiting his domicile with a degree of cabin fever that he was pleased to dismiss, he could neither have suspected, foreseen, or been in any wise prepared as the small two-seater aircraft, with its engine long silent, fell abandoned out of the sky and through the trees before him. Its fall was strangely, curiously noiseless, and nose first into the clearing less than 10 yards from his easel. The gravitational impact and subsequent transformation into a melding of combustibles surrounding their wrecked and mangled skeletal metallic counterparts drew only a minimal yet white-hot explosion, an ignition of seemingly little consequence, given the more common outcomes of airborne failures. A slight earthen tremor was evident upon contact, and what remained did more to agitate an abstract imagination in the artist bearing witness to it than the entire incident accomplished in and of itself at evoking any greater alarm or concern. Had the airplane still been manned, then the doubtlessly tragic consequences would have been far too dire emotionally and otherwise to have manifested any intrigue and inspirations at all. But since such was, most gratefully, not the issue, an unanticipated surge of adrenaline began a satirical dance macabre with his senses and maneuvered him, almost hypnotically, down the rabbit hole of his own psyche. Neruda was slipping unavoidably into realms tangible only to the fantastic in his entirely unpredictable imaginings and spilling thus eventually and inevitably into paint and onto canvas, a credit likely more due his subconscious than ever his waking self. Perhaps the likes of Blake, Picasso, Gibran, Matisse, Rodin, Van Gogh, Gauguin, and countless others greeted him there in regions familiar only to him, each one yielding an aspect of the influences that shaped his own. He suddenly discovered himself anew in this moment, at this time, and standing on the fertile soil where the seed of an idea takes root and snakes along, where sleep and hibernation dissipate into spring air, and where the doldrums and the void shift inside themselves and surrender to the creative process. So there he stood, as deep inside his internal regions as he was outside his cottage, where surrealism and the abstract were no less pronounced or defined, the influence of which still gestating in his soul and artistic vision. His fading white, smudged, smeared, stained, and overworn overcoat was an element of art inasmuch as it was art itself. It revealed a man currently stupefied and dumbstruck by this dramatic shock and imposition upon his otherwise dormant senses, with his kettle and teacup still contained in separate hands.
Bravo, thank you.
Bravo. Interesting story about him. You know, he goes abstract inside and abstract outside.
I think my reason for even holding on to that, I tried throwing that piece away so many times just because it's so unlike anything else I've written. It just sort of swept into me one day and I wrote it down and I've been sort of looking at it ever since, wondering why am I holding on to this? And the best thing I can say in that regard is because I feel that it goes just a little way to explaining to people what abstract art is, perhaps, and you know how inspirations, no matter whether it's artist or writer, come from living life in many respects, or certainly influences of other works. But at the same time, just there are amazingly abstract things that can happen to us on any given day. And I have a friend in whose backyard an airplane landed.
Yes.
So it's not that off the wall.
I remember a friend calling me up one time, and she said, actually, when I said earlier it was an airplane in my backyard, it wasn't. It was a taxicab.
What?
Yes. I was living on Long Island. We all had like two-thirds of an acre apiece, and in back of me was another house with their 2 acres. And I'm busy in the house, and my friend calls up, and she says, Audrey, do you know there's a taxi cab in your backyard?
Did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang start a cab company? What happened?
And I said, no. And her remark was, you know, an airplane could land in your backyard and you wouldn't even notice it. I was busy. It seemed like coming down from another road and it had been icy and whatever. The cab had lost control, had gone through her yard and ended up in my backyard. And there was a cab out in the backyard. And I looked at it and thought, well, I'm sure he's okay. He was okay.
Did you go ahead and tell him you didn't call a cab?
No. I just saw him getting his way to get out of there on and so forth. And I just went back. I just accepted it. Okay, there was a taxi cab.
I think that person in the cottage is you. Might have picked the right person to read that.
I think so. It's, you know, you face... he was so involved with himself and his reaction, which was that of an artist, mm-hmm. and how this stirred up his artistic juices, you could say.
He was so disillusioned from having been literally trapped in cabin fever for mm-hmm. so long that, mm-hmm. that, you know, he was just intent. He wasn't even right. moved to go and report this to the authorities. It was just sort of another color near his palette.
Exactly. And it seemed to have been sent to him.
Yeah, somehow.
I mean, yes. He comes down without a sound and lands 10 feet from his palette, his canvas, and...
10 yards, a little further, yes.
10 yards, okay, 10 yards. But I can't say that I wrote anything or painted anything about the taxi cab. But maybe I should.
Who knows what other abstractions, though, that may have brought out of you. It certainly Absolutely. Gave you some sort of an energy boost. Like, good Lord, what just happened?
Yes. Anyway, that was... It was an interesting story.
It was actually a rainy day when I wrote that thing, and I don't know what made me ponder it. What would it be like if you just sort of stepped outside and without realizing it, this plane comes crashing through your trees. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to obviously parachute out of it and let it drop wherever they could, and so they switched the engine off, and mm-hmm. things just falling out of the sky, and it happens to land near you.
Yes.
So what do you do in a moment like that?
Well...
Go back and pour yourself a drink? Or?
Neruda decided, you know, it stirred up his...
I'm sticking to my paint.
...desire to paint, the way that we express ourselves, and we all have our own ways.
Well, life is so abstract anyway, with you telling us what you told us about L.A. and George Bush being sent abroad. So.
You know, I just remember quite a number of years ago listening to the BBC, who... I think I love listening to them every once in a while. Mm-hmm. When they
I usually catch them at 3 or 4 in the morning when I seem to wake up every day.
Because they say this very objective voice. Mm-hmm. And what he was saying was about someone who was convinced that something on something in Israel, and the mount where they have their temple, and there's a controversy as to... Mm-hmm. Who has the most religious attachment to this particular place.
Oh, right.
And it seemed that it was significant that there would be 7 red cows in some biblical writing or some writing that would be born there or be there, who that would be sacrificed, would mark the coming of the next millennium or the next religious figure. It was some big religious thing, spiritual thing. So this man in the Midwest of the United States had bred these 7 cows and was shipping them to Israel. And I'm just standing there in my kitchen or wherever I was listening to the radio. And again, it was another one of those lunatic things in my mind that he's flying... 7
So is this actually
cows.
Happening?
Yes.
Oh, my Lord.
I mean, this was maybe 12 or 15 years ago, so obviously we have not
so this cow's
succeeded
maybe no
in
more.
Changing the dimensional flux of the of the. Of
Where's the
universe
red beef?
Yet. I don't know anyway. So
Good Lord.
That and,
yeah.
the, and taking
And, of course, people fight you about their traditions, no matter
yes,
how you look at
yes,
things.
Yes, and bless you all out there.
Yes, we may be in the 20th century, but not everything is caught up.
So, Claudio, let's bring something else to the radio theater.
Well, I thought I'd bring something that had a little salt water in it, and since we just spoke of adrenaline, I thought I'd take that issue a little further. We'll talk about this afterwards. But it was, I will say that the story was inspired by the idea of a death grip. It's a very short story. It's called Salt Water and Adrenaline. That bastard son of a priestly affair... more than had it coming when he affronted the old mariner. No one witnessing the entire shuffle between the two saw it coming. Least of all did the offender. A sailor who stood to the right of the old man, a young American tourist to the left of the other, and I at the far end of the bar, were all drawn to observe the situation. We were noticeably affected in doing so by the sheer tense nature of their pantomime and gestures. Anyhow, it was obvious to all that the younger brute, a mate from the schooner Alexander, who was commonly aroused by drink, began the confrontation verbally and was the entire fault of it. On several occasions the old man gestured him away, but his attitude only became more aggressive and confrontational. This continued for what seemed a lengthy period of offense and defense, which gradually appeared to take on a certain gloom heretofore unnoticed. It certainly made the occasion for a drink more interesting to all except the bartender, who, by the distraction of his duties in preparation for a busy evening at port, was and remained oblivious to the psychological metamorphoses at mid-bar. The situation very abruptly began to lose any element of tolerance by its onlookers, and I, having placed my drink upon the bar, was already in motion to bring it to a halt. I had seen enough. The next few seconds held us all at bay, and with bated breath. In mid-gesture of the brute offender, the gnarly-figured old sea-dog leapt from his stool with singular aim and absolute ambition, and wrapped his narrow, long fingers about the neck of this aggressive fool, who was totally dumbstruck and ill-prepared against the sheer momentum of it. Both fell with a heaving crash upon the floor, thus startling even the bartender into alarm. The struggle continued horizontally, and appeared rather conclusively that of the offender gasping for breath and attempting to rid himself of the mariner's claustrophobic grip about his neck, yet to no avail. The old man had very successfully calculated the rhythm of exhalation by the undesired solicitor of his wrath. He had thereupon, in unanticipated momentum, clasped the fool in a death grip from which only an outside support and physical effort could free him. As I momentously regained my advancement in their direction, more due to the lunatic ravings of an unseasoned bartender than my own response to the sudden turn of events, I was to find myself once more surprised. Many minutes had ensued since the impact was delivered, and many a claustrophobic moment hence had yielded the offender no relief in the nature of his struggle. As I arrived to separate the two, I was to witness the younger man slipping rapidly into unconsciousness, while the elderly maintained his gruesome grip. Several of us realized that unless the strangulation hold was arrested immediately, it would bear fatal results. I thus dedicated myself wholly to the effort. This was the moment of my surprise and a shock to us all. It was only with my truest physical force that I was able to unlock the mariner's fingers from about the young fool's neck, and in so doing discovered the old man dead.
Wow. You know, as you're reading it, I'm thinking Poe.
It was very Poe-inspired, yes.
Yes, yes.
One might call it poetic, yes.
Now we'll just strike that.
We have license here today, I'm so sorry.
Poetic license.
I found a few licenses on the way in, I've got it.
That was very well told.
Thank
very
you.
Well written,
thank you.
Very well told.
That was thought of on a drive home one day from some technical theatre work, and it didn't take very long once I sat down to just write it.
When you think of death grip, and you don't think of the person exercising the death grip
right.
as being the one who's dead.
Exactly.
And
that was
process.
The twist I had to throw in.
Right.
Because, you know, it could have been a linear story that went in exactly that direction, but I don't always like the linear, so.
Uh-huh. You just take it a little bit off the regular path.
Right. And the idea of God knows how many fights I've seen during my sailor days in pubs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea, that whole scene was not difficult to imagine at all.
So you've done a lot of traveling around and...
A lot. I spent a lot of time. I spent about a decade of my life at sea.
Uh-huh.
And around the islands. So, yes, it wasn't difficult at all to construct.
Yeah, I was just watching something the other day, and they were in Tangier, and the traveler there was saying, does Tangier still have its reputation of being a rather wild and dangerous place? And the woman was saying, who lived in the area, was, it's a port city. And port
that should say enough, yes.
Port cities always have a lot of sleaze, is the way she described it.
And they always have fights going on, that's for sure.
Uh-huh. That's when I was growing up in New York, and as a young person, maybe 11 or 12 years old, being able to take the Queens Boulevard bus into Manhattan and being given this perimeters beyond which I was instructed never to go,
mm-hmm.
because I would then disappear and never be heard of again. I mean, mm-hmm. my mother really put the fear of horrible things in my mind, and one of them was, don't ever go down to the docks.
Yes, I think actually
don't go past 8th Avenue. Anyway, so it was only like years later I had to go on 10th Avenue, and I was still nervous. It's ridiculous. Well, see what your parents can do to you.
Absolutely.
Scare
they
you to death.
They can wreck you, and I think they know it.
Well, they kept me safe, though, for a while.
Since we just brought in Manhattan, I'm going to do something that will sort of lead into the piece that you're going to recite.
Okay.
We've got a piece coming up by Audrey that I also read some years ago that I wrote in my 20s called Monotony. But first, since
read
we were just...
Read by Audrey, not written by Audrey.
Read by Audrey, yeah. Okay. Written by me when I was in my 20s.
Okay, go ahead.
That's what I said.
I thought you said... Oh, well...
You wouldn't put your name on that, would you?
Yeah, I'd put my name on it, but we'll tell people later why I'd put my name on it.
Okay, right. At gunpoint. That's it. I lived for about a year, or actually a little under a year, a gestation period in New York City. Ran a bar on Broadway. I lived on 96th and Broadway and ran a bar on 106th and Broadway.
Wow.
Called the Blue Star Bar, which was a few blocks away from, Columbia University.
Uh-huh.
And it so happened that the coach, the rugby coach, an Englishman of Columbia University, was my boss at the bar. And we had some great stuff to talk
when
about.
When was this, in time-wise?
This was back in 89.
Okay.
And Blue Star Bar was even used by Michael Keaton
uh-huh.
for a 3-day shoot of the movie he did with Disney called One Good Cop.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which was actually a pretty good movie, and uh-huh. it really defined the era. It was a current film for 89.
Right, right.
But they were just, it was one of those times in my life, and it's funny because it's almost like when you slip into something in path of your life, there are many things that sort of become routine and acceptable in everyday living. And then there are those moments that stand out and you just know there's something special about this.
When planes fall out of the sky.
Exactly, that sort of thing. And yes, and you're not on board, thankfully. But something about the Blue Star Bar, I just connected really well with all the people that I had under my management. I basically took the night shift, and I had some amazing bartenders, and we basically kept the Broadway crowd happy when they came and hung out. Everybody that worked in the bar had to be an artist. You couldn't get a job there if you weren't an artist, an actor, or something in that vein. So, because you know, we were basically entertaining the arts.
Right.
So that was the fitting thing for that, and it really turned out to be one of the great times of my life. And this is written in dedication to my crew there. It's called the Blue Star Bar. The Manhattan skyline is a spectacular sight from the rooftops of Broadway across this city of light. As the road snakes along at a deafening pace, you may wind up at the Blue Star on this side of the race. Though the rats are the victors and the sun has gone down, all aboard, come aboard, we've not yet run aground. Now there's a Mr. Drew Fortley with much to his gain. He's a natural comic in a seedy domain. Then there's young Billy Turner, for whom the ladies all smile. And the calling he follows is somewhat penile. Not to forget Brendan, our actor with true bartender's blues, who indulges his reason with no reason to choose. Oh, and then Tucker, oft given to moods of despair, who may mix you a cocktail, though he's never quite there. Still there's much to be said where Barback Ned is concerned, whose ambitions may take him where positions are earned. To speak of our patrons, I must begin anew, of this realm where pink elephants and emotions ensue. It's a drinking man's haven and a sober man's test, where a working man's tensions are soon laid to rest. Kimberly is our waitress who, from sunset to dawn, remains lost to a romance that has yet to be born. There is Joe, Butch, and Sandy, also Kim and then Bruce, and Eric and Jeremy, all part of the juice. There is young Wendy Fortley, both a sister and wife, whose skillful promotions give artistry life. Then there is yet another whom I may not forget, who carries these memories with no hint of regret. For I once took position on that side of the road, at 106th and Broadway, my Blue Star abode.
Yay, Manhattan.
Making poetry of a memory, it's what that was, folks.
Uh-huh. Excellent.
And I'm going to let Audrey slip right into hers. This is a piece I wrote many moons ago, just called Monotony. I'll let it speak for itself.
I awake from my slumber to stretch and yawn, start work before the break of dawn. From start to finish, it's all the same. You have to play the boss's game. Get up, get down, then turn around until you sweat like a tired hound. I buy the paper now and then only to read bad news again. The laws of the president, the ones untold. Too much for a mind to hold. A man convicted and brought to trial, sented to prison for a while. Why can't the people let it be? Can't they see it's all monotony? I'm going to wait for clearer skies. Wait to see a new sunrise. I'll have to go. I'm the traveling kind. Leave this monotony behind. Turn a new leaf, as the saying goes. Go to where the clear stream flows. I believe in individuality, to be myself and thus be free. So I'm going to release myself from this monotony. Yay, team,
yes,
go!
Monotony, out. You know, something to sort of ease the moment here, just to... We're doing this in a bit of a writer's workshop flavor. So to show you what the spoken word done to orchestration, how that lifts the language even higher, I thought we might play a particular piece of mine, a recording I did with Jim Beckwith on my CD called Blue Whirlwind. And this piece is called Mud in Your Eye. It's about New Orleans getting wiped out by Hurricane Katrina. And Audrey's busy putting it on.
If this is a particular track, or will
it's just the first track, it'll go right to it.
Okay, let me get this in place.
There we go. Line up that target, and we're going to just take a break to take a sip.
Okay, and here we go.
Mud in Your Eye. I've been keeping abreast of the storm's raging quest from a bar in the French Quarter of town. While the gales from the west were all doing their best to hail the apocalyptic Katrina aground. Now there's mud in the eye of the sailor tonight, where broken levees have leveled the shore. And with the warnings all out and the natives in flight, the Big Easy ain't easy no more. When the waters rose as high as an elephant's eye, and knives of wind ceased their cutting about, an eerie silence would sigh as the night gave a cry to the voodoo of time running out. All the souls in despair who felt abandoned by care and whom misfortune did not allow to depart questioned country and state in this quagmire of fate and found it best a debatable heart. A generosity grew from much more than a few who accomplished what politicians could not. But before this was true, an unrest would ensue among the ravaged whom time had forgot. A dead body neglect from the governing sect is the talk of all our daily news. With rivers as streets and all disquieting feats, New Orleans is neck deep in her blues. It's a primitive take when your town is a lake, not to mention the neighboring states. There are strange things afloat in a hat and a coat, all abandoned to partisan traits. At Johnny White's on Bourbon Street, we drank warm beer and spooned canned meat, while Lake Pontchartrain cut a brand new loop and turned a cultural gumbo into toxic soup. It was helter-skelter in a stadium for shelter, where Americans were called refugees. They arrived in great number from a wind that drew thunder, and took comfort where there was no aim to please. With a sailboat for a penthouse that drowned out the church mouse, the hurricane blew in some very sad ends. We paid for our choices with ever-weakening voices, resting far too easy on political trends. A government of the rich is a cancerous itch, and reminder that we have all sinned. Like Bob Dylan would say with his nomadic sway, the answer is blowing in the wind. A president touting religion as a special interest stool pigeon may be facing a rising of tides. Ceasing arrogance not, he may soon face his lot, in whom true power and justice resides. Chaos and creation, known as civilization, are subject to a shifting imbalance ashore. A maligned collective neglect always leads to regret. And the Big Easy ain't easy.
Go.
And that was Mud in Your Eye. I like the idea of sort of writing that story from the perspective of a guy sitting in a bar while Katrina was wreaking her havoc.
And it really does so well with the background sound.
I really like what Jim and I came up with there, yeah. And that is also the piece that I'm going to be performing, providing all goes well, with Anjanae Bell. She's the daughter of the mayor of Durham, a dancer. And she's choreographing that piece to be performed, I think, at the Carolina Theatre in May. I'm going to narrate it on stage, probably somewhat of an interactive narration. And she's going to dance. And I'm not exactly quite sure if she's going to have more than one dancer or if she's going to interpret the whole thing herself. But she's actually from New Orleans and feels very strongly about the piece.
Yeah, yeah. That'll be something to see if she's good.
Yeah, well, I know she's good at what she does, so I'm looking forward to seeing this to the collaboration. Well, in the interest of keeping our radio theater going just a little bit longer, because it looks like we're nearing the latter part of the show, I'd like to dedicate a piece to my longtime friendship, more than 20 years. Had a close personal friendship with Marcel Marceau, the world's greatest pantomime, the Shakespeare of gesture. I always liked that term.
Yes.
And he truly, truly was. I learned so much about movement on stage, and just, you know, how minimalism speaks so much more than trying to serve everything on a tray like television does.
Right.
And this was some years ago. I wrote this just purely on the basis of the inspiration of my friendship with him. We took many long walks together, had some great conversations. We always spoke German, matter of fact.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
He's actually of the Jewish faith. And he spoke German beautifully, as well as he did English. And he also published philosophical writings, which sadly never landed in America. It's all published in Europe. And for some reason,
in English?
Yeah. Huh. He wrote in English.
Hmm.
And even some of the books that I acquired of his from over here, he said, were miserably edited from the European version.
Yeah.
Which really strikes me funny for this land of the free. I think we really got it wrong. It's the land of the fee. F-E-E. Everything else gets cut.
It's our country of litigation, is
That's
what my brother used to say.
And I came to find out during several of these walks, of what truly inspired him into the art of pantomime. And his biggest inspiration was Charlie Chaplin. And also, believe it or not, and these are characters I've loved all my life and still do, the Three Stooges.
Oh, really?
You look at somebody as serious as Marceau, and you think of that as being the ammunition for the energy he puts forth. And it's pretty amazing to think. But taking all that to heart, and my idea in writing this particular piece was to poetically write a performance that he would give, to consider a performance piece. So it's written in that spirit, and it's called Marceau-esque. Like a phantom neath a street lamp, hath he come his trade to ply. Both by shadow elongation and artful gesticulation doth he mesmerize the eye. Creating metaphoric notions like a ship that roves the oceans, or a tree in windy orchard where once souls were gassed and tortured. Then with sparse gesture and pace reveals he yet another face. Tearing off his facial facades, the blasphemy, the blind charades. Then conquered like a forlorn gull, he tears at the mask that adheres to his skull. As death must come to one and all, he reaps eerie harvest of souls in their fall. Thereupon from ominous disguise doth he metamorphosize. Into divinity anew, archangel, having lost a shoe. then politician at his desk, his mockery quite chaplain-esque. A president in mid-campaign, by silver tongue the masses slain. The mimic of tedium and routine, where discontent is evergreen. Pantomime of flowers taken from the garden of love forsaken. His tears emit like a gentle rain, renewing their vigor, appeasing their strain. Then like a spirit he ascends to motion other human trends. This genius of gesture, as silences go, on whom love bestowed the name Marceau. A soul of an angel with a heart for the fool, who doth find in his mime a remedial tool. His compassion is noble, though his empathy bleak. He is the soul's testimony that silence will speak.
Beautiful lines.
Beautiful Thank you. Lines. Beautiful friendship. And he was so touched by that particular piece. And I didn't even realize that he would be so touched. I was just hoping he'd approve.
Yes.
That he drew me a self-portrait with this wonderful letter of how beautiful he thought the work was.
Great.
So I have a sketched self-portrait that he sent me from Paris.
Fantastic. Now, when was it that you knew him?
Oh, well, he's in the last 20 years of his life. He died a couple of years ago.
Right, right.
And we met, every time, I believe it or not, I met him as a waiter in a restaurant. I'd always hoped to meet him. Many years ago, back in the 80s, I was, I worked temporarily, lived at the YMCA and worked at the Hilton right next to it on Hillsborough Street in Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
And he just sort of happened to be at my table one night, him and a screenwriter friend and somebody else, and they were speaking in English, French, and German.
Uh-huh.
So I decided to be a wise guy and take the order in English, French, and German, since I speak those languages.
Uh-huh.
And he was quite impressed that I would do that, and we sort of started joking around, and I asked him if I could get him a copy of some of my work, some poetry, because I felt that spiritually we shared a lot in common.
Right.
And he gave me his room number and asked me to drop it off the next morning. Which
Nice.
I did. I went over to the Hilton Hotel, knocked on his door, and this short little fellow with a face full of shaving cream in his underwear, very European of him, comes to the door, and I looked at him and said, yes, I'd like to speak. Can I speak to Marcel Marceau? And he stands back, and he does this thing suggesting quotes, and he goes, speaking. And we connected
Beautiful.
From that point on. I asked him if, you know, at some point we could take a walk together, and he said, will you be my bodyguard? I said, you bet. So we just hung out. He was performing at Memorial Auditorium at the time, and we'd meet at the House of Pancakes afterwards and go just sort of
Great
walk
fun.
Around Raleigh. It was amazing to meet a soul like that.
Uh-huh.
And I remember him telling me at the time that he was doing a performance in Munich and he'd never had a beer.
Uh-huh.
And Munich is full of some of my favorite beer halls. So he said if I came to watch him to see his performance, that he would drink his first beer with me, and regrettably I couldn't make the performance.
You couldn't get to Munich.
No, but I'll never forget the offer. I couldn't
yes.
afford it at the time. Didn't have the heart to tell him how broke I was.
Right. So. Should have told him. Maybe he would have taken you with him. Who knows?
He probably would have known him. But it was just a very dear friendship and truly a soul I admire, and out of... You know, to be the extraordinary artist that he is,
mm-hmm.
to know him personally, I knew him as a humble man.
Right.
Which was just made him all the more beautiful. Right. I used to walk into his dressing room. I was probably the only person that was allowed to do that. And he'd have the white half on his face.
Mm-hmm.
He would tell his security there to let Claudio, the
right.
poet Claudio, through. And I'd walk in and go, hello, pantomime. And he'd look at me and go, hello, poet. And we'd catch up. So it was a wonderful friendship, and spiritually it will always be alive.
Right.
But it's amazing how many letters I got from different parts of the world, you know, sending me their condolences because my good friend had passed away.
Yeah.
So there was no avoiding Marcel passing on.
Mm-hmm.
But the art world really lost the legend in that regard.
Are there DVDs available of his work?
I would like to think there are, and I'd like to acquire them. So if anybody knows, I'm sure, because, God, he performed with Red Skelton back in on Television Plus. I'm sure his antics were filmed somewhere. I don't have any.
We're just going to have to Google it.
Never came up in conversation when we were together. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it's up on Google.
Check it out, right.
Looks like we may have to bring the Speakeasy Radio Theater to a wrap at this point.
So maybe that the house lights will start to raise and people will be ready to stand up, take a little break, and...
So get that sucker off the stage.
And say, come back. We want to know what's going to be on next time. Of course, next week we have Peggy...
We have Peggy Taphorn, the artistic director of Temple Theatre, coming back on again. I might get her to read her work.
Yeah. That
and
would be good.
She's going to catch us up on Temple Theatre as well as her own spirited self. She's always fun to have on. And then after that, we've got Bob Crowley again, who's with the Apex Council.
Arts Council.
And then I think you mentioned something...
Possibly I have to get in touch with the Literacy Council here.
Literacy,
if we're going to be talking about theater and writing and plays and poetry, I think people should know how to read.
Good idea, yes. I like that idea. Especially us, anyway.
So
we can put on some music and start fading out. I want to thank everybody out there, including the Carolina Theater of Durham, for tuning us in. And we shall see you again on the Speakeasy. Same time, same place, same feeling next week. Thank you. Cheers.